Good morning or afternoon, everyone, and welcome to EMForum.org. We are very glad you could join us today. I am Amy Sebring and will serve as your moderator. We will be providing some instructions as we go along so you can relax and participate with us. And then feel free to experiment with your panel layouts to see what works best for you. And you may also adjust the size of your display using the controls at the bottom left. If you need assistance, you may use the hand-raising button on the participants panel, and either Ava Jean or Lori will try to help you via the chat panel. And then once you have been helped, please lower your hand. Today we are going to hear about how gender shapes disaster, vulnerability, and resilience, including highlights of the new book, Women Confronting Natural Disaster, From Vulnerability to Resilience, and some other resources. Now, please note that there are links to several handouts on today's background page, as well as from where you logged in. First, for the benefit of our newcomers, we will begin with an overview presentation, and then we are going to try out a few poll questions before we proceed to your questions and comments. We will provide further instructions just before we begin the Q&A, but we ask you not to submit your question or comment until we get to that part of the program, and we also ask you not to send any private messages to the speaker or moderator as we will be busy. We are making a recording, which should be available later this afternoon, along with a copy of today's slides, and we are continuing to publish those recordings in the manner that we have in the past. The text transcript will be posted early next week. And if you're not on our mailing list already, you can subscribe from our homepage, and then you will get a notice of when these materials are ready and future programs. Now, it is my great pleasure to welcome back Dr. Elaine Enerson, who has done a number of programs with us before that you can access from our archives. Elaine was lead course developer of a FEMA course on social vulnerability and has written a number of gender mainstreaming manuals and planning guides for emergency managers and community organizations. Elaine was a founding member of the Global Gender and Disaster Network and initiated the U.S.-based Gender and Disaster Resilience Alliance, and we're going to be hearing some about those organizations today. And links to both of those efforts may be found on today's background page, as well as further biographical detail. Welcome back, Elaine. Thank you very much for joining us today. I now turn the floor over to you to start us off, please.
That's great. Thank you so much. Amy and Ava Jean, I know you're out there too someplace. I just have to begin by saying how great this M-Forum has been and what a contribution it has made. I'm saying that just as a disaster person and also, of course, as a presenter, but it's a wonderful resource, so I'm sure everybody here agrees. Thank you also to everybody who's taken some time away from a busy schedule today. It's a beautiful outside where I am, so I'm particularly grateful for that. We don't have much time, and I'm just really wishing that we could be around a round table with some coffee, but we're not. Please do feel free, though, to get in touch later, because these are very complex issues. I'll just be doing a really quick run through, and there's a lot to say and think about. So warm welcome to everybody. I'm delighted that I recognize a few names, but not all the names, so it's an opportunity to meet with some of you perhaps for the first time. So let me tell you a little bit about what I'd like to do, just as you see in front of you, just a quick review of some of the new resources that we have and a look back and a look forward. I'm going to be focusing particularly on a recent book that I did for some reasons that I'll explain in a moment. It is a growing field, and I don't know about you, but I have a bookcase of gender and disaster that's pretty heavy now, and it has a number of new texts. But I wanted to just begin by letting you know that there's a lot more coming. You know, whenever you write a book or you try and do a synthesis of what's out there, you know that it's just the tip of the iceberg, and that's how I'm feeling and putting together this material. There's a lot more coming, as I said. A few of the things you see here on the screen, a new book coming from Canada that I think is going to be quite interesting to those of us here in the States as well, on different kinds of masculinities. And my colleague and good friend Emmanuel David, with whom I edited The Women of Katrina, is going to be bringing out his own book that's focusing on the elite women of this storm and their work around Katrina. A number of other books there as well coming from this conference in Turkey. There's a new conference coming up very soon in Bogota, and perhaps there'll be more writing coming from that. So it's a growing field. This book, I'm really happy to say, has finally come out. You know, you begin a project and you think it'll take about a year. Well, you know, triple that. It took quite a long time. But, you know, Emmanuel and I really were concerned that the discussion around Katrina at the policy level and in research and certainly at government levels was not reflecting the importance of gender, wasn't really even talking about women and men as gendered people, in the interest of focusing on race and class and age and disability, which, of course, are very important. But this was also an event that touched us as women and as men and as boys and as girls. So we're able to pull together this book. Here's the a little bit about it. And, again, it's out in paperback. So Bill Anderson was kind enough to write us a foreword. We talked a little bit about us as non-residents of New Orleans and how that situated us as researchers. And we tried to put this Katrina experience and this literature into context by doing a brief overview of the gender and disaster literature. Because we wanted to make a point that women were writing about gender from the get-go after Hurricane Katrina. We begin with a section about protests, or letters to the editor, and short statements like that. And then we moved on to first-person testimonials from volunteers and from women who were caught up directly themselves in this event. And then have two larger sections, and here's where you'll see the empirical research, a wonderful range. I hope, I'm just a fan of this book, I hope some of you have seen it already. A range of work ranging from, for example, a qualitative analysis by the CDC of the impact of pregnancy on low-income African-American women in the New Orleans area and their decisions around evacuation. Two very qualitative pieces, such as the one that was done by Chris Peterson, University of New Orleans, with the Women of the Bayou and the way that they integrated faith and the significance of place and land into how they responded and how they coped with this event. Work that's really, I think, path-breaking around women with disabilities, writing about what happened to them. A little bit of insight into groups that we don't often think about. Jewish women are represented here, women who are Latinas who are working in construction. You'll find, I hope, a little bit of something for everybody. At the end, we brought together some of the major writers in the field. You'll know the work of Kathleen Tierney, and she situated this analysis within the disaster sociology field as a whole. And Brenda Phillips, who's just really moved this so forward in her work and always drives home the point that the reason that we do this research is to have an influence on practice and on policy, wrote us an article, a really wonderful article, bringing together the policy implications of this work. So if you haven't seen The Women of Katrina, I hope you will. I hope you find it useful, and please be in touch with us. And I would say the same thing about this book. This is a book that I wrote as a labor of love. It's finally come out, and there's a discounted ordering form attached to this presentation, so please go there. Don't go to the Internet, because that book is a whole lot more expensive, and unless it becomes wildly popular, it will stay a hardback only. So these are some of the chapters of this book, and that's what I'd like to use to structure my conversation with you all this morning. Just a really quick walkthrough of that to give you a flavor of the issues as I see them right now, looking back after 20 years of research. So I began by writing a very short preface explaining, you know, why I wrote this book, and I'll just tell you briefly. It was because I was on the airplane going to Sri Lanka right after the tsunami when Katrina happened, and I just was so felt so powerless and fundamentally at odds with my own country that I wanted to come back and try and make a difference in some way. And I've sort of done quite a bit of work now around research in the United States, but not as much practical work as I'd like to do. I do a fair amount of consulting internationally, but we need to bring these issues home. So that was the genesis of the book. It's focusing on the U.S. for the reason I just said. It highlights women because this is where the empirical data are at this point in time. And I'm one of the people who've always called for more work on men and masculinities, but we don't have it yet. So this is a synthesis of the existing literature, and it's predominantly about women. It's natural because the publisher really wanted that word in there, and I was not able to succeed in changing their mind. I don't restrict my analysis to so-called natural disasters. And it focuses on resilience because that's such a powerful concept in use right now. I'm a little bit critical of how it's used sometimes, and I don't, of course, mean to imply in that title that there's a continuum that we go from vulnerability all the way to resilience. We are everything at once, as you know from your own work. So it begins with a chapter that just puts in context this work in the larger literature and helps walk people through and acknowledges the many, many people who have contributed to this field along the way. The second chapter then launches into something that I just really enjoy talking about, and that is how people in the larger world outside of our emergency management field, outside of the classroom, think about disasters, because that's perhaps the most important place for us to be, for us to make a case around the significance of gender and disaster, for us to bring these issues up. And all it takes is a short discussion with students or with anybody on the street about disaster films, and you go single very quickly to race, class, and gender. So there's a lot to say about there, and I had some fun in this chapter pulling it together and touched on some of the things that came from the Titanic as well, you'll see. I think the importance of popular culture is that it provides people a chance to tell their own stories, which sometimes can test kind of received wisdom and certainly represent different people's perspectives. So one of the things that I did, you'll see this picture here, this is a little picture from Eve Ensler around the Vagina Monologues, a presentation she did in New Orleans after Katrina, integrating some of women's stories around violence into this representation. And I've, for those of you who have read a little bit of some of my other work, you know that I love quilting, women's quilting. I think it's a very powerful medium, has always been historically for American women. And so I talk a little bit about the significance of women's quilts there. So if you're interested in that, please check out that chapter. Because, again, I think it kind of contextualizes, let's see, contextualizes the work. So why I think that matters, I think I've spoken to that already. We do need more intellectual work around how women and men may use social media in different ways and use graphic arts or fabric arts or different forms of different voices, if you will. I think, again, it's a very powerful tool for us. Let me move on to the next chapter, which is, again, a kind of an introductory chapter. It's theoretical, and we often hear that the gender disaster work, like a lot of disaster work, really, is not theoretical enough, and I would agree with that. It's very important because theory helps shine a spotlight, does it not? It's a predictive, explanatory rubric or mechanism that helps us anticipate problems and issues and helps us make priorities, if you will, to borrow Dines and Rodriguez's language around Katrina, helps us find and frame. So here I kind of situate the sociology of gender within the sociology of disaster and try and make some connections there. I've done this before in an article with Brenda Phillips, but we looked at theory and method as well. And here I wanted to represent, for those people who haven't had a chance to study much of feminist theory, it's an area that I started with as a graduate student, the different strands, if you will, it's a braid, of course, a braid of thinking historically around gender and gender relations in this universe of ours. So there are a multiplicity of ways of thinking about women and men, the relationships between women and among women, between men and among men. Gender, of course, is not about women only. And I make a case in this chapter for how each one of these kinds of lenses offers something a little bit different to emergency management. Different lines of action emerge from those perspectives. And it's, again, I think it's important for the reasons that I've said. We do need, I believe, to move toward a more grounded, environmentally focused perspective on gender and disaster. And here I think that the great opportunity to work around climate change in particular, not only because that's such an important driver, but because it's a way of as I said before, of grounding in place. All the literature around disaster and around emergency management comes again and again to this notion of place. And yet too much of our thinking around gender and gender and disaster in particular, I think, has been too abstract. And I would include myself among the people who haven't sufficiently taken that on board. I think also as we move forward, theoretically, we really need to connect with other people who are thinking around sustainability issues and certainly around the people, men and women, who are writing more about masculinities, in the plural, as a dynamic force that needs to be and can be potentially an important part of this dialogue. So theory is important. I know it's sometimes a hard take, but I'd love to talk with you more about that if you're interested. A little bit more on a practical base, then, is this fourth chapter where I wanted to tackle this question of vulnerability and capacity, making the case, of course, that we need to understand both capacities and you know, both the resources that people bring, the life experiences that women and men differently bring, their assets, their strengths, their networks. There's such a large and undeveloped field there, as well as a ways of getting a better handle on what we mean by vulnerability. So I begin the chapter with a discussion of some of the familiar patterns of gender-based vulnerability, again, focusing on women, so women's poverty, women's single-headed households, the women as disproportionately represented among renters, et cetera, et cetera. And most of the chapter, though, focuses on different approaches. I really think that we rely overly much on quantitative measures of vulnerability. So I do believe that it's incumbent upon us as emergency managers to begin to, as part of this know your community and then know the whole community, to build those relationships and find out the stories behind the numbers rather than to rely on overlays on maps that that rely on census data. However, being a realist and a pragmatist as well, I know that that's often what we do. So I've written quite a bit about some cautionary notes. How, for example, you might look at a woman here. I've shown just, for example, a single mother on the bottom and a woman with a certain disability on the top. You might look at and see that as vulnerability and map it on our overlay it over proximity to a nuclear power plant or to a floodplain. But it doesn't get us very far, does it? Because we don't know their story. We don't know whether the woman on the top leads a major social service agency that is already well in touch with emergency managers and is centrally involved in bringing the resources of disability communities to the fore. We don't know if the single mother is living in a large extended family or if she's alone. We don't know if she's English-speaking or not. We don't know her income levels. So unless we can begin to get the story behind the story, we really can't say much of value. So we stop a little bit too short. Having said that, I do in this chapter talk about some other census data that I think we underutilize. For example, the proportion of women who are heading families alone with young children who are renters. I mean, that's a figure that might be more valuable. We could put these things together. So it's a cautionary note about how we're thinking about vulnerability. Again, here I think I've spoken to most of these things. I do think that risk mapping, when it engages communities and when it engages women, is much more meaningful in the long run. And that's, again, emergency managers don't have a lot of time to get it wrong, basically, right? So while it might be faster on the one hand to do a short kind of social risk mapping to engage the communities and engage the women's organizations and men's organizations that understand where women's strengths and weaknesses lie, or capacities or resources and vulnerabilities lie, just gets us a lot farther in the end. And I do believe under this section of needed that when you are using government-supported research, government data, tax dollars, that it's really incumbent upon us that we get the whole story. So I'm a firm believer that this should be a standard in all disaster research, actually in all research, that sex-specific data be provided. It may not be at the top of your research agenda, but others will want to know, right? And, of course, we need to get more and better gender indicators that speak to men and boys. I think if we do it, if we get it right for women, we'll get it right for men as well there. So the next section of the book, five chapters here, look at particular issues that have emerged from the field. And, again, this is a compilation, a synthesis of the existing literature. It's not the body of knowledge that I wish we had, but it's what we have now. It's quite extensive in some ways. I mean, other nations don't know as much about, as we, I think, in the United States know about disaster and the United States, but other nations, in my view, are using what they do know more effectively. We're not there yet. So that's partly why I wrote the book as well, to bring together these issues and from there begin to launch a conversation of a more empirically grounded discussion around what we might be able to do about it to build a stronger and safer nation. So five chapters. This first chapter on health and well-being pretty much wrote itself because, as you may know, this is where most of the literature lies. This is really where we can begin to parse out sex, the physiology of sex, the physiology of reproductive health, from gender, which, of course, is about the gender division of labor and the gender power relationships that exist within families, within relationships, and between women and men in different contexts relative to race and class and age, different power dynamics. So there's a lot here, and it's one of the areas that's most widely researched, not always, in fact, I would say almost less often from a disaster position than from a health position, if you take my meaning here. I think most of the people who come to this area don't come as disaster specialists. They come with an interest in maternal health, for example. So it's a wonderful example of how we can work together, we being disaster, students of disaster, with other allied fields of people who have research skills and have practical tools and have connections in the community, have policy frameworks, and we can begin to integrate this work. So as you see, these are the main topics that I took a look at. There's, a plethora of knowledge around the implications of stress, for example, on maternal and infant health. Not always in one direction. It's a little bit of a complicated story, but it's an important one. The area that's most well studied and most well documented is that women report more symptoms of post-traumatic stress or negative mental health effects of one kind or another, leaving a lot of questions about why and about how long those might last and about whether that's a reflection of women's capacity to speak about that or whether it's a reflection about some more deeply embedded issues. We don't know. It's a lot that we don't know. But it's important, of course, because these are life and safety issues for this generation and for the next generation. And because the kinds of responses and interventions that we make, unless they're gender responsive or gender sensitive, will simply miss the mark. We will not be able to help women or men, boys or girls. We won't be able to intervene in situations to make midwifery more available, for example, or to provide better reproductive care so that every child is a wanted child after disaster as well as before disasters. I think that some of the things that we need, obviously, are to develop the capacity in women's health services, especially at the community level, because so many women, particularly poor women, women who are isolated, women who are speaking, non-English speaking, will rely on a local clinic or an informal network of women health care providers. So these are our natural allies in emergency management. We need to reach out and connect with them. And as you see here, I've listed, I have many, many research questions in my mind, but we really do need to focus more on the implications of disasters for men's reproductive health as well. We also need to look, when we do have sex-specific data on post-traumatic mental health, it's often around men in response roles, and I'd like to see a lot more work on those broader population of men. Violence Against Women is another chapter that I thought was important to include in this book because, again, in the United States, it doesn't get the kind of attention that it has received elsewhere. There's a broad and growing database that indicates that when you ask the question, we don't always ask the question, and you ask the question of service agencies, which is how we're currently measuring rises or potential rises, increases in sexual assault or domestic violence, you will find that for the most part, service agencies report increased demand and diminished capacity to respond, which is the contradiction that we have to address. So this chapter, I have a critical discussion of the database. It needs improvement. We need to take it seriously. It's a significant public health issue. And I walk through this chapter with looking at the data, as I say here, from Exxon Valdez to Katrina and Reeder, and take a close look at some of the explanations, because, of course, it's not as simple as saying that it's a question of stress alone, is it not? I mean, if that were the case, it would be rampant, right? There are choices that people are making all the time about how to cope with the stresses that they may have. So I think here we need to learn from and connect with our allies in the domestic violence movement who can help us better understand how important control and power issues are around violence. So again, this is a public health issue. It manifestly discourages women, and my focus here is women, on reaching out, on using existing resources, on being visible to authorities, on even accessing shelters, or reaching out to FEMA or acknowledging issues to Red Cross. So when we put together our protocols for shelter workers, we need to be able to ask, first off, are you safe? Do you feel safe? And make that a screening question. We need to find safe places for people to be, women and men. We need to have, again, community partnerships so that when our shelters and when our resources are not suited to women who live with fear or live with violence, there are other avenues that we can provide for them. Here again, I've listed a number of other research issues. Again, a major gap in our knowledge is around men and violence and around the gay and lesbian and bisexual, transgendered and queer communities. And that's a plural group of women and men who are so often overlooked in many ways, right? We need to look at trafficking as well here. We need to look at domestic violence as an issue in the lives of older women and of women who live with disabilities, women who live in different faith communities. There's a lot to be learned around this, and the more we learn, the more we can begin to mitigate, to plan for, to anticipate, because this, again, is one of the effects that we find repeatedly. So just conscious of the time here, let me move ahead a little more quickly. A chapter on family. And there's a fair amount of literature here, again, making the obvious point that relationships that are strong before disasters tend to be stronger afterwards, but that when there are fractures and how many relationships out there do not have these stresses and strains before, disasters can often be devastating and very divisive. So I spent some time talking about that. And looking, again, particularly from women's perspectives, about the importance of this, of just being tired, of overwork, of being the person who, the go-to person, right, in ways that men don't experience. And let me just speak to that for a moment, because, of course, I'm not saying that men are not overworked or tired of disasters. Would be ridiculous, no. But that in addition to the physical work, women are often doing the emotional work behind the scenes. They're caring for the men who are out there working so hard in other ways, right? Taking on domestic labor in households where, as you see in this picture, the stove may be outside if you have a stove at all, right? Households sometimes get much smaller. They generally get much larger. They have fewer resources, a lot longer commutes. I mean, you know the story. So it was a lot to do, a lot to pick up, and very often it falls on women. I think that we need to focus a little bit more, as I say here, on disaster mothering, and I would also say that we need to learn a little bit more about disaster fathering. But because of the central role that mothers play in bringing people together again, getting those kids back into school again, trying to find ways to support everybody, getting back to work again, meeting the emotional needs of infants and the physical needs of infants and young children, we have to figure out ways to support them more effectively, basically. And it would be hard to talk about family without talking about child care, so of course we need to develop the capacity within child care organizations. There's a lot of progress in that area, but in my view, not enough. We need to really examine our disaster risk reduction templates, our models, our frameworks, for everything that we do in the field, and ask always, are they family-friendly? Are they women-friendly? Do they represent the diversity of households and families in this country? There's a lot more that needs to be said there. With respect to housing and homes, I think this is one of the most egregious examples of pre-existing vulnerability, because it doesn't take long to establish that women have very low levels of housing security internationally, and that's true in the States as well. So lack of affordable housing, more likely to be renters, more likely to be couch surfing and invisible, even in work around homelessness, to be displaced by violence. So housing is very important to women for that reason, for the reason that they're subject to insecure housing to begin with, one divorce away from homelessness in many cases, I should say in some cases. But also in this chapter, I take up this question of home protection, if you will, of mitigation, of preparedness, of how people work in the home physically to prepare. And here is again, a fairly well-established body of literature about women as effective risk communicators. Women are the ones who more often than men, because most Americans don't do mitigation, as you know. They don't do preparedness. They don't listen to emergency managers. But when anybody is, it's going to be more likely women than men. Gender has been proven to be an extremely important and powerful predictor of evacuation decisions. Now, whether that's gender, whether that's parenthood, whether it has to do with age of parenthood, we haven't teased out all of those different questions. There's conflicting data on that point. Here also I talk a little bit about women in temporary accommodations and some of the experiences in shelters and really women, again, doing that behind-the-scenes work of making a house, be it ever so humble, be it a corner of a shelter, into some kind of a home. And also get into this question of roadblocks to resettlement. There's such a large negative case study in Katrina on that point that I took up that in that chapter. Again, I think this leads to an understanding that we need to really, in our risk communication, prioritize talking with women in some respects, but also prioritize figuring out ways to talk with men around things like evacuation, the need to evacuation, the need not to drive around fire barriers, as is happening in my own community so often when we have fires. We need, I think, also to support women in home construction roles, which is one of the major avenues of economic recovery for men and not yet in this country for women. To do more research, as I said, on some of the things that help women and men get back on their feet and get back into housing, a huge subject, of course, in our country at large, but in disasters, even more important. Work, by which, of course, I mean unpaid work as well as paid work, different kinds of work in workplaces. The gender division of labor is obviously one of the most important and most cross-cutting parts of gender relations in any society, and certainly in ours as well. It doesn't take long to understand the pay gap once you understand the division of labor gap, right, and the greater value accorded the work that men do as opposed to the work that women do in the society. So in disasters, that's reflected as well. But we need to understand, and in this chapter I review some of the literature on what happens in disasters. Women are less able to go back to work than men, of course, because of competing demands at home. Women have greater economic losses, again, because so much of our income is based in the home. We earn money often out of those beauty salons or those editing, those freelance offices down below in the basements where we raise children or do family daycare. And women whose incomes are based on resources. We'll talk to the women along the Gulf Coast or around Exxon Valdez about that. So there are a wide variety of different kinds of barriers, family and work conflicts being one of them. In this chapter, I also wanted to make the point that in our language around disaster responders, first responders, we so often look at men in men's occupations or women in traditionally male occupations such as firefighting. But I think that we need to, again, highlight in our work, in our partnerships, and in our capacity-building efforts to look at women who are primary school teachers, for example, women who are lay faith leaders, women who are working in community agencies and working as mental health counselors and informal and formal health care providers. These are women who are central, they're respected in their communities, they're often at the head of complex networks or webs, if you will, of social networks. And that work that they do is an extremely important piece of work. So again, those are some of the areas that we'd like to focus on. I do think that in our economic recovery plans, to the degree that we are doing them, and we need to do more in this country around that, they need to be gender sensitive, and part of that is to make sure that all the data, all the analysis has sex-specific data to provide for the possibility of doing gender analysis, excuse me, and that it also incorporates paid and unpaid labor at work in the informal, which is to say the contingent sector, working part-time, working a number of different jobs, working in insecure locations, as well as people who are working in full-time large bureaucracies that may be able to provide more support to disaster-affected people as they try and get back to work. There's a lot to be said there, but again, just looking at the clock here, I'd like to get to hear more from you as well. So those were my five chapters around the effects, if you will, the impacts. And even as I was writing, I was frustrated myself because this is the state of the knowledge to date, right? We know a lot about what happens to. We know really far less about how women respond to what women do, what men and women do together, what they do separately, what they do at odds. And as one of the people, again, who's contributed to this body of knowledge through field studies in the United States and in Canada and internationally, I'm always looking at what happens to women. I'm no longer going to do that. I have sworn off not another impact study. So you heard it here. So the last three chapters of the book, I wanted to take a different focus. So here I, sorry, I really took a closer look at what women do in the immediacy of disasters and in the aftermath. So, of course, highlighting the volunteer work that women do as individuals. I think probably my favorite picture of all time is the three women in Iowa who have just delivered lunch to some of the other people working the floods in different ways in Iowa. And this is Sharon Hanshaw on the top, who's the wonderful woman who, after Katrina, moved from the beauty salon that was destroyed in the storm, to running Coastal Women for Change, a new NGO that's helping women adapt to some of the different changes in their lives, partly out of Katrina and partly due to climate change. It's a good example of an emergent organization. Is it 20 years ago that Betty Hearn Morrow and I looked at Women Will Rebuild in Miami as one example, and I'm just happy to see that we now have a slowly developing kind of sense of the diversity of ways that women organize collectively. So this chapter, while I acknowledge, I respect, I applaud, and I think we need to support our women volunteers, of course, who work individually, as a sociologist, I'm more interested, and I would say as a disaster sociologist, I'm more interested in what women do collectively because it has legs, or it potentially has legs. So I examine some of the forms of women's work around disasters in the United States with case studies, looking at work that's grounded in service work, service organizations, so often this international might be one, looking at women's work that's grounded in faith. And as you know, that's one of the most important kind of organizing rubrics for anybody, and particularly for women, I think, to get into disaster work. Work that's organized around social justice issues, so working on anti-racist groups that have been so important in bringing the issues of power and equality and justice to our dialogue around disaster risk reduction. So women of color in the lead here. Looking at women who have organized around faith, around social justice, around feminism, so around women's rights organizations that have really stepped up in important ways. But in this chapter, I also spent a fair amount of time just wondering, thinking out loud, if you will, about how sustainable they are. To my knowledge, very few organizations actually exist for very long after disasters. Now, Katrina Warriors, an anti-violence group in New Orleans, is one example, and Coastal Women for Change is another, so perhaps this is going to change. But in the chapter, I speculate about some of the sources of difference between those, but also some of the ways that we might assess the durability, the capacity of organizations to stay around long enough, I would say, for them to be part of the team, if you will, to become part of the disaster risk reduction community. That's a two-way street. We need to work with our organizations to reach out to disaster managers, and disaster managers need to understand their communities, know where women are, know how women have organized and what they can bring to the table. And then also in this chapter, I put forth a number of research questions. So let me just move on. I think I've mentioned in this slide, I don't think there's anything I need to highlight here. The next to the last chapter is again about resilience, and I speculated a little bit about that concept and how, of course, it needs to be much more than the bounce back notion. I'm quite critical of gender mainstreaming if we don't ask what are we mainstreaming and how and why. But here I talk about the entry of women into firefighting and, of course, into emergency management, but again has some cautionary notes about that. I take up here a little bit of this notion of what I call the empowerment thesis, because sometimes we hear, and I think I've written the sentence myself, that disasters can be empowering to women. It's an opportunity to, for example, leave violence behind, or to learn new skills, or to negotiate a different relationship with the critical men, with your father, with your brother, with your partner, with men at work. But I think on balance, so far from our existing knowledge base, again, in the United States, it's the other way around. The disasters, if we're not getting it right, if we're not understanding what we're doing and why, we will reinforce racism, classism, sexism, heterosexism, ableism, everything that we're trying to change about our country, we will reinforce in building back poorly, making poor decisions, if we don't confront the power relationships that are embedded in disasters. So I also look at a different level, at the international policy level, at the HILGO Framework for Action and at our country's response, because gender is understood in the HFA as a cross-cutting principle, the one that can't be isolated, can't be marginalized, but must be centrally involved in every one of the five priority areas of the HFA. And I'm quite critical of how little really our country has done there. So then I go off on a very speculative end, just to wrap up the book, talking about the enormous potential, I think, that lies ahead in this country for women's movements, which have historically been leaders around children's rights, around environmental justice, around civil rights and human rights, around anti-racism is what I was trying to search in my memory for. So we have been leaders in social justice movements in the past, and I think that we are seeing globally, and I hope here at home as well, women stepping up around climate change issues, which I speculate in this chapter may be the cutting-edge issue that will bring together communities in our country in a way that has never happened before. And that will happen, I think, only when women become part of the dialogue, part of the community. Here in the United States, we have such an opportunity to bring this discussion of climate change adaptation and disaster risk reduction together. And I think that women being centrally located at both of those, both as energy users, as natural resource users, but also managers and prevention workers and ecologists and environmentalists, in spirit, protecting the household, protecting the land, protecting the community's needs and anticipating them, I think we are well situated. Whether the younger generation will actually see this as an opening or not, I don't know, but this is my, I kind of went off on a deep end there, speculating, so we have to see what you think and let me know. But I do believe that this approach around resilience demands, really, around the whole community, really demands that we look at social justice issues and the ways that inequalities currently undermine anything that we might want to mean by resilience. So you see here that I've listed a number of different steps I think that we can take, including the lessons I think in terms of research that we need to learn from the global north, from the global south. The last chapter, again, I just made kind of a heartfelt statement about how I think that there's a long and rocky road ahead, but I am just so respectful of the work that disaster managers and disaster advocates do in the community. I really do believe that this is a challenge that the nation will meet together, but it's essential we won't get there without women and men working together. So that was the conclusion of the chapter. I did end with an appendix, which probably, let me just go back to this, which will be out of date shortly, but I've included in this presentation a revised list, and I'll probably continue to produce those because there are more and more resources out there. But I find in my work that the templates, the models, the training pieces, the practice guides, whether they're used or not, I think unless we have a community, unless we provide the networks and the social relationships that would make that work meaningful, it doesn't do much good to provide yet another set of checklists or selected resources. So again, let me know what you think. I think it's essential, it's a necessary, but it's not sufficient to have those kinds of practical tools we need, again, to build the constituency. All right, so let me very briefly go ahead and summarize a few things before I give the floor to you, because I have some polling questions coming up. So looking back, obviously, there have been significant changes, and I'm so sorry to say that in terms of awareness that I was out of the country. I was actually talking on gender and disaster issues in Australia for this entire week. But there was an important discussion around women and young people in emergency management, and perhaps some of you were there and can tell us a little bit about that. We, emergency women and emergency managers are much more organized than they were in the past. I and other people have been developing more teaching resources, and there will be a revised gender chapter in the revised social vulnerability book. The new Gender and Disaster Resilience Alliance, and I'm one of the people who's trying to get this started. It is a sister network to the Global Gender and Disaster Network. And the idea here is that the work that we do at home is parallel in spirit and in nature to what's happening internationally, but different because the country is different. Every country is unique. So we need to have a U.S.-focused initiative here. So if you haven't already visited, I do hope you'll come to the USGDRA website and see the kinds of resources that we have. And I'm so pleased to say that Emergency Preparedness Initiative Global, and thank you to Elizabeth Davis and your colleagues there, are partnering with GDRA, and one of our first partnerships together, we'll be developing a webinar series on gender and disaster, so stay tuned on that. But looking back also, there's a lot of issues. There are a lot of issues that we have yet to really take up in any significant way. So I mean, the bottom picture, the women on the left might be lifelong partners. We don't know. But we do not have a sense of what happens to lesbians, to gays, to bisexual kids. We really do not understand. And when you're talking about social marginalization, we have to go there. We have to examine trafficking. We have to not always put our dollars where most people are, but understand that the people who most need disaster manager, who most need assistance, who most need those resources and that networking are perhaps the people most invisible to us, and that has to change. So we need more knowledge about youth, obviously about boys and mothers, and about Native American women and men and families in particular. Persistent policy gaps as well. I think that if you look at some of the new changes in FEMA and our policy approaches in this country, they are so strong and so promising and yet to date so gender blind. Now, please chime in here because this is how I'm seeing it. I do not see a recognition of gender as a cross-cutting theme in that respect, and I certainly don't in the professionalization of emergency management. I do a fair amount of teaching in the field with the emergency management students at the graduate level in the United States and Canada. I don't see that gender is any kind of a core competency in the field. I think it should be. I welcome your thoughts about that as well. Putting together this talk and thinking about how GDRA might contribute to gender work in this country, I love to develop projects, unfunded, totally unfunded projects, but let's talk about how we might move this forward. So at least 10 practical steps that could be undertaken. There already exists this template that I helped develop with some other colleagues from the Caribbean. that's a grassroots risk mapping methodology, really. It just needs revision, needs to be brought up to the United States. I'm going to be talking with colleagues in the United States, Canada, New Zealand, and Australia about how to assess some of the most promising practices around gender violence and how to reduce it in countries like ours, and maybe perhaps do some demonstration work and some evaluation research, I hope. And really, this is, I think, one of the most important things we need to do is to develop risk-targeted messaging that focuses particularly on men. You don't have to read very far in the extreme heat literature, for example, to understand how very important this is. I think that's an example of a very doable project. I'd love to see more work around children be a little bit more gender sensitive. There's wonderful work going on around in this area, but I think, again, there's a lot of room for making it more gender sensitive. The GDRA has developed the idea of a Women Building Disaster Resilience campaign, believing really that we have to build on the experiences of the women, for example, who went through Katrina, who could talk with women who have just been through Irene, who have just lost their homes as in the tornadoes, right? In who communities that are preparing against earthquake in the Northwest, and the communities all over the nation that are preparing for a pandemic, to build on the knowledge that they have gained, a really hard-won knowledge, to meet in a kind of a meet-and-greet speakers bureau, two- or three-day field site visit model, to meet both with women's organizations in local communities and with emergency managers. So I think that's something that we can really contribute to the dialogue. I would love to see a national roundtable of women's organizations called, again, at the very highest levels, to ask them, so you're thinking about NAGWA, the National Association of Business Women's Organizations, or looking at some of the Social Justice Institute women's organizations, ask them to help us make the connections with the work that they are already doing. Here, number seven, I'm doing a lot more work and reading myself around climate, so I'm being an academic. I would love to start at least with an annotated bibliography that might be able to bring some of these connections together. And being a firm believer in training as well, I think this is something we've all talked about for a long time, but still has not been developed, a user-friendly resource for certification programs and also you could use it for college coursework, something that summarizes in a simple way some of the major gender issues. And I think number nine is perhaps my top priority of all right now because I'm so concerned that as we move forward, we don't yet have a good sense of integrating gender holistically at a policy level, at a practice level. We've made such progress around questions on disability and questions around children, a little bit less effective work, in fact, I'd say substantially, around gender, around race, and around class, and that's the future. And networking, we really do need to develop, I think, a simple way that would become a tool of the trade, a kind of a baseline, good practice model for bringing together women and men. I'm surprising myself always by calling for single-sex organizational work, because I'm usually on the other side of that. But I think here in this field, it's a really good way to capitalize on the strengths that do arise when women work separately and men work separately and then bring us all together. So there are lots of ways forward, and I think just, again, looking at the clock, I'm not going to speak to these points, but if you're interested, and this is why I love M-Forum, because they archive these slides, you can come back and chime in here. These are just some examples of how I think we might be able to begin more work in this area. So building up the GDRA is my very important, I think, to a lot of us. Building more and broader partnerships. I have a list like this in the book as well. Many, many people doing excellent work out there, often working on women's issues, on gender issues, but not with a sensitivity to disaster. So if we can help make that connection, we broaden our community of practice as well. A lot of room for doing more teaching. If anybody knows, I mean, I have an online gender disaster course ready to go. I've taught it once already. I'd love to teach it again. I'm just one person. There are many other people who can and should and will do this work once we decide that learning and teaching about gender is important. And policy development. I think we need to really take a close look at these five action areas of the HFA and ask ourselves, how are we approaching these in this country, and how can gender and sensitivity to women and to men and to boys and girls be integrated through that holistically? And the same goes with respect to the whole community approach. It's quite taken by looking at the document itself and looking, as I always look, for some reflection in the examples chosen, in the language chosen, in the illustrations, in the analysis, in the references. some recognition that that the world is gendered, that gender relations are deeply embedded in everything about our intimate life, our households, our organizations, our communities, our organizational work around disaster. But I didn't see it, and in particular, because I'm a really picky person, I just bring you one example. If we're going to have photographs of the Boy Scouts, could we not also have pictures of the Girl Scouts? And if you haven't seen it already, go to YouTube, see this fabulous public service announcement that these sweet girls have made with our Department of Homeland Security head secretary standing at attention there. It's a wonderful story about empowerment, about connections between Empower and Women in Emergency Management, DHS, and the women and men in Empower who are role models for the next generation of young girls working in this field. Could have easily been illustrated in this book as well. So, I'm a fast talker. I hope you're still with me. I have lots of different questions, but now I'd like to turn it back to Amy because I have four or five kind of polls, and I thought maybe we could use that as a basis for discussion. And before I hand it over, just please, if we don't have time, we run out of time, you have other thoughts, please email me. I'd love to hear from you.
Thank you very much, Elaine. And if you want to go ahead and advance to the first poll question, you will see them up on your slides, and but I will open the actual poll, and it should display in a new panel in WebEx where you can select your choices or enter brief responses on the last one, and then you'll click on the submit button. And we'll give folks a few minutes for each one, and then I'll display the results, and we'll move on to the next question. And please note, if you need to, you can make that poll panel larger by dragging the left edge. So I'm going to go ahead and open our first poll question, which is about, in your view, what accounts for gaps in research policy and practice. And with this polling tool, we are able to select multiple answers. And you'll see I've kind of substituted a none of the above, and this question two is a spot where you can chime in, as Elaine has encouraged you to do here. And we'll give it a moment. I'm seeing some progress.
This is why I don't use multiple choice questions very often in my exams.
We're just going to have to give it a moment and give everybody a chance. And as long as they keep changing, I'll put it up here. And you're welcome to talk over these while people are responding, Elaine.
And can the people see only one at a time? I think that's right.
On the questions, yes. We're just working on question number one here.
So just to let you know, there are four little poll questions, and one is that what accounts for these gaps, and the next is going to be what some of the drivers of change might be, what are potential champions of this work, and what should be the primary focus of our work. So these are all huge, huge questions. But for this first one, I would love to know, this is really a mystery to me, what accounts for these gaps?
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and waiting. Click on the closed poll. It's taking a moment to respond. Let's see. Uh-oh. There's a problem with the audio, evidently. One moment. Let me go into the chat and find out if anyone is having, has lost the audio. One moment, please. Let's pause and see if we can get some feedback as to whether audio is still connected. I'm not sure what the problem is. I've had a couple reports. Okay. Apparently, we do have audio okay here in Seattle, so apparently, it's not everyone. Oh, okay. All right. So we have some poll results, and you'll see we have probably the largest percent had selected all of the above in this one. Okay, now we can move on to poll question two, Elaine.
All right. I put in that all of the above, wondering about that. Well, the two I think is related. What are the drivers? And this is a language that comes a little bit from the HSA, but what are the main sources of change, we might say? Is it mainly going to bubble up from the grassroots? Is it mainly going to come from women? and or men in emergency management, or some of the other options that you see here are all of the above. I would be really fascinated to know what your thoughts are. If we understood that a little bit better, then we know perhaps where to put our energies.
All right, we'll give it a moment. I guess some people are fine on audio, some people are having difficulty, but I hope our recording will be all right. That's the main thing. And we'll give this one a moment. We are kind of getting short on time here.
Yeah, we can't move ahead to the other two yet, I guess.
No, we'll give this a moment. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and try to display, close this one and display it. Oh,
okay.
You know what? I think I forgot to display the results before. I'll make sure I do
that's
it.
That's okay.
And
so where are we now? We're on three?
We're waiting for poll two to close. Okay, now I can show the poll results. And this one is fairly evenly split. Very interesting.
Let's see. Oh, I see it's over here. Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting, yes.
All right, we can go on to number three, if you like.
That's a little bit more later. Sorry, and who are the potential champions of this work? Again, it's a closely related to the other question, but a little bit different. Again, who are our natural allies here? If we're talking about partnerships, about networking, about outreach, what are the most important connections that we might make? I always think in five-year plans, so think about maybe short-term, long-term. What are your thoughts?
And folks are voting on this one. Apparently some folks have had are still having some mm-hmm. audio problems. I don't think we've lost everyone, but we have lost
okay. But they can still can they still do the poll, I guess?
Yes, I think
okay.
so.
I just need one more second at the end to talk about resources, and that's it.
Okay. And we'll go ahead and close this one and display.
Nope.
And we'll put up the results here on this one. Again, this one's kind of
okay.
mixed.
See, now I'm really wishing that we were sitting around that seminar table, folks. The last one really is you know, what should be the primary focus in the United States? It might be different elsewhere. So, again, these are very broad questions. If you'd like to just email or we could talk a little bit later or post a question on the listserv to the GDRA, it would be lovely. But your thoughts today are so welcome. Boy, we are out of time. No, oh, wait, this isn't the right.
All right, and I'm going to go ahead and close that poll. We'll put the results
yep.
up in a moment, but if you want to go on to the resources,
I will. Yeah.
That in, let's do that.
All right, so having just glanced at the clock, and I know everybody has many other things to do, I'm sorry, we won't have much time for discussion. The last slide I wanted to put up here is about some of the resources, just so that you know a little bit of information about the GDN and the GDRA. Please circulate those. We would love to have those listed as resources on your own website. Book ordering forms with discounts, I emphasize. And the Women of Katrina book, I just wanted to let you know Emmanuel and I are donating all of the royalties to the NIS Foundation because their work along the Gulf Coast with women's organizations was so important. Women Confronting Natural Disaster, I'm trying to recoup the cost of my indexing on that book, so I didn't donate those. There's a resource sheet, as I said, of selected resources that I updated in 2012 with some new things, for example, from the CDC on a reproductive health toolkit, really some interesting work there, and a piece on gender in the HFA and gender and masculinity that I've done for the GBN. And I just now sent Amy a moment ago a French and an English version of a document, very short, kind of publicly accessible statement called Not Just Victims, Women in Emergencies and Disasters, that friends and colleagues in Manitoba, you know, I was teaching up there, put together. Margaret Hayworth-Brockman from the Prairie Women's Health, the Center of Excellence in Beautiful Winnipeg, has generously printed those out and shared the PDF. I'd love to see something like this in the United States or perhaps this exact one, and maybe let me know if you think it's worth trying to get it translated into Spanish. We now have it in English and in French. So those are some of the resources. I'm really sorry that I've talked so much. This is kind of a character flaw. I do it all the time. But I do thank you for tuning in, and I really appreciate your answers to these poll questions. And again, if you'd love to, I would love to hear from you, and hopefully we can continue the dialogue. Meanwhile, thank you, Amy. Thank you, Ada Jean.
Thank you very much, Elaine. It is definitely time to wrap for today. I'm putting up your email address again just for a moment for folks that may want to follow up with you. But on behalf of Ada Jean, myself, and all our participants today, thank you very much, Elaine, for taking time to prepare and share this information with us today. And we wish you every success with your continuing efforts.
Thank you. We'll see you next time.
Yes. Now, let's see. Folks, before you go, please do take a moment to give us your comments, how useful was the information. And, again, if you're not on our mailing list, you can just go to our homepage to subscribe to get our announcements, and you can also find us on Twitter and Facebook. Until next time, thanks to everyone for participating today. Sorry about the audio problem at the end here. I'm not sure what that was, but we hope you have a great afternoon and come again. Thank you. We are adjourned.
Amy,